Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
After a quick period as a teenager in New York, not quite sure what it was, Mormonism settled down and got a job in Kirtland. You can make a solid case that Mormonism becomes Mormonism during this period, sort of puberty for Mormonism. They start keeping records, structure settles in, and theology unfolds. Maybe their voice changes a little bit. But before becoming a respectable adult in Ohio, Mormonism had to go through its angsty college years. We talked earlier about the transition from New York to the two centers of power, the headquarters in Ohio, and a sometimes troublesome outpost in Missouri. Let's dig a little more.
The most influential episode in the beginnings of Kirtland was the missionary group, including Colliver Cowdery and Parley P. Pratt, passing through Ohio. They had great success in converting a group all at once, and it was highlighted by the baptism of Sidney Rigdon. And as would happen over and over through the coming years, a new convert immediately enters Joseph Smith's inner circle and begins influencing the course of Mormonism. Sometimes, this pattern leads to a long, fruitful association. Rigdon's a good example, Colliver Cowdery's a good example. However, this pattern sometimes backfires spectacularly. See John C. Bennett. Rigdon, after his baptism, wanted to meet Joseph Smith and headed off immediately for New York. And once there, the Bible Revision Project really takes on some momentum. Don't worry, we'll get back to that because it's extremely interesting. But early Kirtland, what's happening on the ground?
Okay, anyone out there ever seen the show Arrested Development? And if you haven't, you should see it. There's this great episode where the family is having a Valentine's Day party at Lucille and George's, and they have all this momentum, they get excited, and they start yelling, speech, 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 and then it stops, and no one knows what to say or what's coming next. Early Kirtland is like this. There's this initial burst of excitement. Everybody's gathering. They're going to build stuff. Then what? What now? The missionaries arrive in Kirtland on November 2nd, 1831, and are gone within 3 weeks. It was a particularly interesting setting because there was a loose organization already in place among the new converts to Mormonism. A group heavily influenced by prominent seeker leader Alexander Campbell had settled around Kirtland, usually called the Family.
The early 1830s were a time of communal experiments all over the place. Curiously, I found, several were started by Scottish-born reformers that relocate to America. In addition to Alexander Campbell, one of the more exotic ones of these was Robert Owen. Intending to try and improve the conditions of working people, which was a big concern for many of these reformers, he sets up this initial community at New Harmony, Indiana, to start what he called, quote, a new moral world. Then another Owenite community starts in Ravenna, Ohio, which is very close to Kirtland. And the family there would definitely have heard of Owen and their ideas. As historian Mark Staker noted, quote, economic cooperation was at the heart of Owen's reforms, close quote. I found this great. Their symbol was the bee. Robert Owen declared, quote, he is the most moral bee which creates the most honey and consumes the least of it, close quote. That's a man after Brigham Young's heart.
And listen, I think about these early movements a lot because now in the work that I do, I get to interact with a lot of what the outside world would call cults and what I would call Mormon groups, right? So I get to see this, and I have talked to people who have been in and out of like three or four movements, and some of them are what I would call a cult, very culty, you know, weird rituals, dangerous rituals, abusive things to loosely formed religious organizations that speak to this. And I'm often wondering why, like what's happening. But it's really easy for me to understand in my mind these movements. And I love this story of these folks in Kirtland. There's something about the area still, if you go today, that there's sort of a magic in the air. So these seekers looked to the book of Acts in the New Testament for their mission statement. Chapter 2 describes a group of, quote, one accord, in which, quote, all that believed were together and had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods, and parted them to all men, as every man had need, end quote. I don't think people understand how that phrase, all things in common, is going to play out in history over and over and over and over again. Northeast of where the Kirtland Temple would soon be built was a farm owned by Isaac Morley. We know that name if you're a Mormon. An initial group of 11 families began as a commune on his property. So think of our early ancestors, if you come from the Morleys, as just a bunch of hippies, because that's kind of what they were, farmer hippies. This group, including future apostle Lyman White, was joined by a branch of the family a few miles away. Now, if I thought of a group, a religious group, all living together called the family right now, I'd think they were a little freaky. But I like, it's kind of Charles Manson-y. It kind of is. But this additional collective included John Johnson, whose family would be integral to the development of the Mormons. The farming operation existed alongside a barrel-making industry and blacksmith shop. Part of this will especially appeal to some modern Mormons. Peppermint grew like crazy in the area, and they distilled the extract and sold it. Yay, essential oils!
One question that is difficult to answer is, how closely did Isaac Morley's family group adhere to Owenite ideas? So the Owenite concept of marriage tried to reform it. They wanted to reduce the economic dependence of women, which was a very noble aim, we would add. In addition, due to the communal nature of their plans, it included some hints and rumors of free love, which might have just been good old-fashioned pre-Victorian gasping about what the crazy kids were up to. And even though it obviously wouldn't succeed, and I imagine a 19th century communal vision not working out, it's crazy talk, but the family organization in Kirtland led right into the law of consecration that Joseph Smith introduced. And actually, some would argue that the relationship was the other way around, that Joseph Smith's law of consecration actually derived from some of the family's ideas, which again kind of derived from Owenite ideas of communalism.
I'm sorry, but every time we talk about groups like this, early Mormonism, the family, I have to contrast it with my experiences now with all of these religious groups that I meet. And, you know, my LDS family sometimes thinks that I do crazy work, that I'm dealing with crazy people. And I think that's who our ancestors were. It's so weird. It's so wild of me to think that our ancestors were like these communal hippies. Like, they really were. I mean, 1970s correlated Mormonism was terrified of these kind of people, right? Because this is what they were. They were figuring out ways to make everything fair and equal and responding to these ideas of the Enlightenment. And I think it's kind of fascinating. Our ancestors were a little bit nutty.
One story that just makes me laugh along those lines is BYU did not want the group, the association, to come because they were way too hippie and way too dangerous. And if you know them, that makes you laugh. Again, remember, our ancestors were pretty radical in a lot of ways. And part of our sanitizing our history over time means that we've lost our roots and we've lost kind of what created us. And that's a little sad. So that's one of many aims that we have in this podcast, is to restore our roots and the things that made us.
That's right. It's a restoration podcast, my friends. So because the family wasn't a structured group with a clearly defined set of beliefs, not surprisingly, the early religious culture of Kirtland was pretty wild. That's why it's fun. Since Mormonism also wasn't yet structured, either in terms of hierarchy or theology, not much changed once the missionaries left. With no designated leader or program in place, they were left to their own ideas and motivations, and we've talked about this in some of the episodes. It seems like the Morley family sort of took the lead and started preaching their simple concept of Mormonism to the other families in the area. We don't really have a clear picture of what their meetings looked like, in part because they probably evolved week by week. It was a growing thing. There was no structure. We do get a few fascinating hints. Several decades later, George A. Smith, whose storytelling talents we've already mentioned, so take this with some salt, described a man named Black Pete who became a revelator. Mark Staker argues that this Peter, a freed slave, combined the shout tradition from his slavery background with an element where they would, quote, act, they say, as the Indians did when they were carried by the spirit, end quote. And, you know, we've talked about this in the last episode, this playing Indian idea. We bring it up a lot because it's really a part of early Mormonism. And Black Pete would have taken traditions as a mechanism of his own survival, taken the tropes, the racial tropes that existed of the time of Native Americans and, you know, enslaved Africans, and amplified those and performed those so he could, you know, curry white favor.
And if at this point you're thinking, whoa, this Black Pete guy sounds really interesting, hopefully you know us well enough by now to know that's not all we're going to talk about him. We're going to do an episode here very soon about early Mormons of color and talk about his experience and some others. So wait for that. And at this point, we get a great example of existing practices being infused with some uniquely Mormon elements. So it seems like what these people would do is they would draw on the story of King Lamoni in the Book of Mormon. If you remember, he falls in a coma for 2 days and then he revives and tells him this wonderful vision he's had of Jesus. So the family read the Book of Mormon, really dig this story, and then they start mimicking this experience. One person collapsed, quote, like he was dead. After an hour or two, he would come to, then prophesy and tell what he had seen, close quote. And it seems like these types of the more exotic, the more charismatic spiritual manifestations appealed particularly to younger people. Those crazy kids, always wanting the hip new thing.
Okay, and I just want to talk about this because I think it's wild and crazy. And there is actually a fragment of scholarly work on this, but it's the entheogenic theory of religion. This is interesting to me because I just read Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, about the history of psychedelics and sort of the scientific study and all of that. It's really fascinating read if you want to understand sort of these movements a little bit more. But anyway, you know, I'm reading about psychedelics, and there is a theory in Mormonism there's a theory with religion in general that all, and I'm really being reductive, but basically all religious movements started with a psychedelic experience trying to be translated to the sober. And there is a theory that exists like that within Mormonism. You can look it up. It's, you know, that Joseph Smith found plants in Kirtland and they were spiking sacramental wine, yada, yada. But if you think about this, if you think about all the herbs that they were experimenting with, we do know this. We do know that by the time Joseph Smith's family shows up, they were doing this stuff in New York. They were experimenting with the herbs and magic and concoctions and tinctures and all of this stuff. This was happening in Kirtland. And so I'm not saying that that happened. I don't think we have a lot of documentary evidence to suggest it, but it certainly makes sense to me. And, you know, we had a Sunstone panel one time where a scholar compared a psychedelic trip to these ecstatic experiences that they were having in Kirtland, and it matched up like hour to hour, sort of what they're talking about. All I'm saying is it's a compelling theory. Okay, Brian, you're going to hate me, but I want to take this into the weeds a little bit further. I want to talk to someone who knows a little bit about this subject. So I have with me Bryce Blankenagle from the Naked Mormonism podcast. Bryce, can you say hello?
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, Lindsay.
Okay, so before we get into why I brought you on today, tell us a little bit about yourself and your podcast and what you do.
Yeah, so I'm somebody who grew up in the church, and I left as a teenager just through apathy. I didn't really enjoy going to church very much as a teenager. And, you know, a few years later, I began studying church history, and I just found that it was almost magnetic. I couldn't get away from it. And the more that I learned, the more I realized how much I really didn't know that I didn't know. And since then, you know, I've been doing Naked Mormonism for 5 years now, and it's just the rabbit holes keep getting deeper and more interesting, and, you know, there be monsters in these rabbit holes. So yeah, that's kind of a skinny on me.
So the history sort of brought you back.
It did, absolutely. And, you know, I consider myself secular Mormon. I don't believe in it, but I am, you know, a product of the culture. My people are Mormon. So that's the way that I'm Mormon is through secular Mormonism.
Well, perfect. Thank you for coming on today. We want to talk about something that some people still see as controversial because of the nature of it. But society is getting more and more interested in the topic entheogens and psychedelics and sort of the impact that it has on mental health and things like that. But there is a theory that applies to Mormonism. And when I first heard this, I sort of dismissed it outright because it sounded bananas, right?
I get that. Yeah.
Bryce is going to help us untangle sort of the entheogenic theory of Mormonism.
I'm going to do my best to do a very short version of what we call the Smith entheogen theory, because I personally believe that there is a fair bit of explanatory power within viewing history, or Mormon history specifically, through a lens of entheogens. And what are entheogens? They're basically chemicals, plant medicines, or practices that get us into a state of mind, an altered state of consciousness that can cause theophany. An entheogen specifically usually refers to things we consider psychedelics, as in, you know, magic mushrooms and LSD and these things that are the more common, you know, street drugs that we talk about. They have a long history of human usage and implementation into various religious practices. And I also need to preface by saying things that we see in early Mormon history, there's some wacky stuff there. we'll be getting into a couple of the quotes from the early Kirtland era, but there's just some interesting things there. And people get into these states of consciousness where they are swinging around swords of Laban and they're chasing letters that are floating through the air or magical white orbs. And these very odd kind of spiritual manifestations. I want to preface this conversation by saying a person can get into that altered state of consciousness that causes hallucinations through meditative practices, through religious chanting, through Pentecostal type spiritualism, through speaking in tongues, through breathing rituals, through yoga. But I postulate that the shortcut to get to that state of mind is through plant medicines. And I think that plant medicines were used in the early church in order to get large portions of the Mormons into the state of consciousness where they could have these very spiritual and esoteric and, you know, somewhat Pentecostal type of manifestations.
So you actually believe in this theory. You believe it's a viable explanation for some of the ecstatic experiences, because scholars have tried for years to, let's say that you don't subscribe to the idea that it was just God and angels for one brief period of time were speaking to people in Kirtland and Kirtland only, then that stopped. Some people have tried to come up with all kinds of theories. There's theories that, you know, Joseph Smith had, he had trauma from his leg surgery, and we've kind of talked about this on the podcast. There's theories that people were just whipping themselves up in a frenzy in sort of this shaker style camp meeting.
Yeah, I think there is explanatory power in it, and I do believe in it personally because I think there's enough explanatory power that when we view church history, especially the Kirtland era, through this lens, that pieces begin to fall in place that otherwise don't necessarily don't look copacetic at the first blush. And personally, I kind of when I was studying the history of the Kirtland Temple dedication ceremony for the podcast, I remember reading the accounts of this and just thinking out loud, like, this sounds like drugs. So I broadcasted on the podcast that it sounds almost like they were doing drugs here. And I got an email from a guy named Cody Nacone. And he said, you have no idea what you've kind of stumbled on here. And he sent me a few resources. And that began Cody and I working together to create what we call the Smith entheogen theory and then present on it at Sunstone in 2017. And so far, the feedback from that presentation and from the paper that we self-published and gave out at the same time has been overwhelmingly positive, all the way to just skepticism. There are a lot of people who are very skeptical of it and say, well, you know, show me the evidence. There's some people who hand wave, that doesn't sound very believable. But then there's another massive swath of historians and people who we present this to that say, yeah, I think you're onto something. I want to see this out there, or is this going in a book, right? And that's always the big question, is what's the evidence for this? And unfortunately, the evidence really requires a lot of pulling together disparate pieces and cobbling them under this Smith entheogen theory umbrella and saying, is it plausible that psychedelics provide the key explanatory piece to why all of these things are happening?
Okay, so people can approach this with a heavy dose of skepticism.
Please do. Absolutely.
But tell us, what's the theory?
Essentially, there's a long tradition in history, especially in early America, frontier America, of using herbal remedies for all sorts of ailments. And it was often a sub-base of knowledge that was passed from mothers to daughters, because if your mom was really good at keeping your kids alive, she was going to have more kids that survived in frontier America. They didn't really have hospitals the way that we understand them today. They didn't often have doctors that were nearby that they could go talk to. A lot of what medical remedies comprised in the early 19th century in America was what you could forage for in the forest and then combine and use basic kitchen chemistry in order to, you know, turn it into filters and potions and unctions and colliriums and various ointments. And things that you can use as medicine in order to heal what ails you. So coming out of this tradition is Thomsonian herbal medicine. Prior to Thomsonian herbal medicine, there was no codified version of herbal remedies that physicians were using at the time. It was a lot of just, it was kind of the Wild West of whatever herbal remedies that they wanted to use. That's what they were using. Thomsonian herbal medicine comes out in the 1820s, and Samuel Thomson was able to codify a system of medicine based all on herbal remedies that had apparently profound effects. Thomson was also brilliant in his marketing, because in his book, in his family vegetable medicine book, he would publish it with a certificate in the front that was basically a physician's certificate that, hey, I bought this book, I now have all these remedies, I am now a physician. So he was good at marketing, and he was extremely prolific and published multiple editions of these various herbal medicine books. Add into that, we also have the Materia Medica books. So the Thomsonian family vegetable medicines described the ailments and described the ways that various herbal remedies were to be applied. And then the Materia Medica is what was used to basically describe the recipes of how to make the various medicines. And there are a few standout passages that I can find from one of the most prominent and well-circulated Materia Medica books. This is from 1822. Jacob Bigelow published this in Boston. Background on this first, one of the psychedelics that we postulate had an influence in early Mormonism is of the nightshade family. It is Datura or Belladonna. There's this entire subclass of what are known as the hexing herbs. And Datura and Belladonna are both members of this, and they're all members of the nightshade family. So Jacob Bigelow's Materia Medica book describes Belladonna. It says, "The Atropa Belladonna has bell-shaped flowers of a brownish or dusky color, yellow at the base, at the inside. The berries are of a dark purple. The leaves have a nauseous, subacrid taste without smell." And then, so that's what these Materia Medica books are. They describe the plant itself and then how to use it and the symptoms of using these things. It says in 1822, "A peculiar alkali has been announced by M. Brandis as existing in this plant, and which he calls atropia. It is white, shining, crystallizable in needles, insipid, little soluble in water or alcohol, and capable of neutralizing a considerable quantity of acid to form salts. It is highly powerful, and even its vapor is injurious. The whole of the plant is poisonous, producing in large doses intoxication, attended with thirst, nausea, insensibility of the retina, causing a dilated pupil," which maybe some people who are in the listening audience are familiar with dilated pupils, "constriction of the throat, coma or delirium, convulsions, and other dangerous symptoms of narcotics." And here's a really remarkable passage in here. It says, "In fatal cases, the stomach and bowels are found inflamed and gangrenous, and the whole body becomes swollen and highly putrescent." I want to fixate on that passage because a lot of people have postulated various medical maladies that caused Alvin Smith to die. And when the autopsy was performed, it was found that indeed his stomach, his intestines were inflamed and gangrenous. And here we have in this 1822 Materia Medica book, just a year before Alban Smith died, a description of overdose from belladonna causes those symptoms in fatal cases. I find that quite remarkable.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting connection. That's one I haven't heard before. But there's other evidence too, not just this kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. And I should also note that in the dosages for all of these are the hexing herbs are commonly used as putrescents, as some of them say that they can cure cancer and, you know, piles and all sorts of interesting maladies. But it does also note that the commencement dosage increases nausea and vertigo. And that's when you know that you have the proper dosage, because if you go any further beyond the person having nausea and vertigo, they can fall comatose, they can go into convulsions, and they can die. But notably in all of this is the Joseph Smith Sr. dream, as reported by Lucy Mack Smith in her biographical sketches of the prophet Joseph Smith. In one of Joseph Smith Jr.'s dreams, he describes what sounds like a datura plant. It talks about the plant, that it was exceedingly handsome, that its beautiful branches spread themselves somewhat like an umbrella, and here's the important part, it bore a kind of fruit in shape much like a chestnut burr and as white as snow, or if possible, whiter. Now, if any listeners want to see this, I would recommend that you Google the datura plant, because you see that the seed pods of it look like chestnut burrs and they're green, but when they ripen, they turn white and they open up and expand and then shoot their seeds out of the front of the seed pod. You can eat the seeds and they are extremely psychoactive. So, Joseph Sr. says, I gazed upon the same with considerable interest, and as I was doing so, the burrs or shells commenced opening and shedding their particles, or the fruit which they contained, which was of dazzling whiteness. I drew near and began to eat of it, and I found it delicious beyond description. And after that, he talks to his guide, who tells him that this is the pure love of God that he is feeling. And anyone who has, ever participated in using psychedelics or entheogens, you know that sense, this pure love of God feeling, the overwhelming sense of just pure love and just beauty that can be attendant with some of these psychedelic experiences.
Interesting. And so I've even heard that they've matched up some of the accounts in Kirtland with a psychedelic trip, like experience for experience, hour per hour, and it matches up.
Yeah. The first place that I saw this was in a fun little book called Hearts Made Glad by Lamar Peterson. And it's also, notably, there's a long passage in Rough Stone Rolling that talks about the very odd experiences. But in Hearts Made Glad, there's a few passages that I think are quite notable here. One of them says, some church members lie in trances a day or two and visit the unknown regions in the meantime. Some are taken with a fit of terrible shaking, which they say is the power of the Holy Ghost. There's from John Whitmer's history, he says, he, meaning Joseph Smith, took a notion to blind the minds of some of the weaker members and make them think that an angel of God appeared to them and showed them writings on the outside cover of the Bible, and on parchment which flew through the air and on the back of their hands, and many such foolish and vain things. Others lost their strength and slid on the floor, and such like maneuvers which proved greatly to the injury of the cause. Some had visions and could not tell what they saw. Some would fancy themselves that they had the sword of Laban and would wield it as expert as a light dragoon. Some would act like an Indian in the art of scalping. Some would slide or scoot on the floor with the rapidity of a serpent, which they termed sailing in the boats to the Lamanites, preaching the gospel, and many other vain and foolish maneuvers that are unseeming and unprofitable to mention. So, I mean, that's from John Whitmer's own history. Then we have the account of Peter Kerr, who is often referred to as Black Pete. He was born into slavery and owned by the Kerr family, and then he likely had some hoodoo magic and medicine that was passed down through his culture. There's this Geauga County Gazette that was published in the Painesville, Ohio in 1831, and it talks about what happened with Peter Kerr that is just remarkable. It says, quote, they profess to receive some sensible demonstrations of the presence of the deity. A few days since, a young man gave information to some of the brothers that he was about to receive a message from heaven. They repaired to the spot designated, and there, as they solemnly assert, a letter descended from the skies and fell into the hands of the young man. The purport was to strengthen his faith and inform him that he would soon be called to the ministry. They declare their solemn belief that this letter was written in heaven by the finger of God. The style of writing was the round Italian for some reason, not Reformed Egyptian. I find that interesting. And the letters of gold, the favored youth immediately attempted to copy the communication, but as fast as he wrote, the letters of the original disappeared until it entirely vanished. And here is quite interesting, some of the manifestations that we see. It is alleged that some of them have received white stones promised in the second chapter of the Revelations. Such of them have, as the Spirit will declare, that they see white stones moving about the upper part of the room and will jump and spring for it until one more fortunate than the other catches it. But he alone can see it. Others, however, profess to hear it roll across the floor. These two stories and others of a similar character are told by them with a solemn asseverations to their truth. So there's just a lot of these parchments and letters that are floating down from the sky, and there are white orbs that people are chasing through the air, but only they can see it, and when they catch it, it disappears immediately. There's just a lot going on that is truly remarkable. That is truly remarkable that I haven't been able to find in any other religious tradition at this time.
Okay, and another interesting thing. So for this particular episode, we're talking about early Kirtland, the family, the communal living, and then it sort of builds into all of these ecstatic experiences. Do you see any connection between sort of communal living and psychedelics?
Certainly, and there's plenty of tradition of that living today. Some of my best friends live on communes. It is notable. There's a quote from a physician who was living in Kirtland, and this was actually given in, I believe, 1887, that this quote was provided, that Jasper Jesse Moss told about his early Kirtland experience. And he talks about the Morley farm, where, of course, the Smiths lived very briefly when they first emigrated from New York. And the way that he remembers this, I think, is extremely remarkable. Now, granted, this is a very late account. This is not from a believing member or anything to that effect, but it is still a remarkable account, and it comes from somebody who was a trained physician. He says, quote, "I commenced teaching school in Kirtland in the fall of 1830. The week that I commenced my school, three Mormon preachers came from York State. Two of these preachers I recollect, Parley Pratt and Oliver Cowdery." So he's describing when the missionaries first got into Kirtland and began preaching. This is when they converted Sidney Rigdon and Edward Partridge before those two went up to New York to meet Joseph Smith. And then he continues, "In the course of the winter, I attended their meeting." And here's another brief pause, because we see replete throughout church history these prayer meetings that they would hold, these closed-door prayer meetings where they would partake of the sacrament. And during the Kirtland era, these are very interesting. A lot of the Kirtland era revelations come during these prayer meetings. So those prayer meetings had their beginning on the Morley farm with the missionaries that first traversed across and were headed out to Missouri. He continues, "I believe I was the first person with a young man whose name I have forgotten who was present when they took what was called the sacrament up at the Morley house. They were in the habit of turning everybody out of the door when they partook of the bread and wine, putting up blankets at the windows, shutting off the sight from without. They started a regular powwow, and when they got well going, they then opened the door and let us all come in again. A young man and myself made it up that we would stay in unless they took us out by force." Basically, this guy, Jesse Jasper Moss, wanted to see what was going on during the sacrament meeting. And that's, he said, "I'm going to stay here unless they throw me out by force." And then he describes the scene. "The young man got asleep, and I had the dumb evil and could not talk." The dumb evil, I think that's a remarkable point. "But they did not carry us out, but went on with the sacrament." And then he describes the meeting as a whole. "The poorhouse in Portage County, Ohio, where there were half a dozen insane and idiotic persons, was the best comparison of anything to the scene that night." And then he wraps it up with saying, "And if I had my cloak on, I would have stolen the wine and carried it home to see whether it was drugged or not." So a physician at the time wanted to steal their wine to see if it was drugged, because he can only describe the events in the Morley farm by making an analogy to the poorhouse, the insane person's house in Portage County, Ohio.
Fascinating. Okay, so that sort of backs up my thesis that our early ancestors were a bunch of hippies.
Totally. Absolutely. And it is so fantastic to know that they were hippies, and not just hippies, but drug smoking hippies. It's great. It's they're Woodstock, you know, 0.5.
I know. Okay, so what other compelling evidence to back up the Smith entheogenic theory?
Most notably, I think that Joseph always kept close to him physicians. And it all began with Dr. Frederick G. Williams. And I gave the impromptu presentation at Sunstone last year because there was, you know, somebody had canceled their presentation and there were, you know, 15 people in a room and there was no presentation. So I said, hey, can I present on this? I think that Frederick G. Williams happened to be Joe's guy. I say that kind of tongue in cheek, but if Joseph Smith was using psychedelics, he needed somebody who could be a steady supplier, who could provide him with enough of a well of these plant medicines in order to frequently use them. Frederick G. Williams happened to have an herbarium on either side of his house, which also was mentioned in Eber D. Howe, you know, the first anti-Mormon book, Mormonism Unveiled, in 1834. Frederick G. Williams was called as Joseph Smith's personal scribe. He replaced Jesse Goss as the second counselor in the presidency when the presidency was formed, with Sidney Rigdon as first counselor. And we have in Eber D. Howe the mention of the herbarium on either side. He says, in Kirtland, F. G. Williams is a revised quack, well known in this vicinity by his herbarium on either side of his house. And then he talks about the word of wisdom coming out and how Frederick G. Williams, being an herbal physician, likely had something to do with allowing every herb in the season thereof passage within the context of the word of wisdom. Notably as well, when Frederick G. Williams became a member of the church, he was, you know, he joined up with the mission troop on the way out to Missouri, and then he bounced back and forth from Kirtland to Missouri throughout his entire ministry, entire time during the Kirtland era of Mormonism. Joseph Smith Sr. was given control of Frederick G. Williams' herbarium and farm, and there's some speculation about this, but the Kirtland Temple, part of it was actually built on Frederick G. Williams' land. And notably, Frederick G. Williams, prior to him converting, his old business partner went on and made a wine business, selling his own wine of his own make, I should say. So Frederick G. Williams, there's a lot that centers around this guy. And his entire time in the church, he was a vegetable physician. He published a number of advertisements that he was a Samuel Thompson's vegetable medicine doctor, a botanic physician. When he was in Quincy, he published in the Quincy Whig, Frederick G. Williams, Indian and German root doctor who distinguishes disease by the examination of the urine, and then describes all of the ailments that people have and how he is able to effect cures for all of them just by getting a sample of their urine. And it's all just really quite remarkable how much centers around Frederick G. Williams. And then notably, he unfortunately passes away in his 50s in 1842. And I believe that Joseph Smith at that time had other outlets that he was able to acquire these medicines if he was still indeed using them during the Nauvoo era.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know, you brought up I've read a few articles. There was a presentation in 2007 about the sacred mushroom, but you've really added some really compelling things to this theory.
Well, it's more just digging and digging and digging and seeing what we can find, because to begin with, this was just something I stumbled upon. And then reading Dr. Beckstead's work, Restoration in the Sacred Mushroom, it's like, oh, wow, here's the blueprints. Cody and I took Dr. Beckstead's blueprints and then built the entire Smith entheogen theory on top of it. And it's one of the theories that, if it holds explanatory power, why is it not something that we should be exploring as much as possible? And I mean, I have a lot more information. This is obviously a very short dive down this very deep rabbit hole. But really, I think that there is enough explanatory power there, and that it's something that has been basically absent from versions and models of early Mormon history, that if there is enough explanatory power that this is a plausible or even a possible theory, then it merits exploration. It merits its time in the realm of Mormon history academia.
Well, where can people who want to find out more about your work and research in this, where can they go to find out more?
If people want to see my presentation at Sunstone on this, this was with Cody, my co-researcher in the theory, that that is uploaded. We videoed that. It's on YouTube. It's under Smith-Entheogen Theory. And I think I gave a clickbaity headline of, did Joseph Smith drug the early Mormons or something to that effect? So it should be pretty easy to find. My self-published paper, well, currently the website is down. The website should be up in a few weeks here. Unfortunately, that's what happens when websites get hacked. But the self-published Sunstone paper is available online. And I've also done a number of episodes on this. If you search for Smith Entheogen or just Entheogen in the backlog of Naked Mormonism, there are a number of episodes to that. I discuss it extensively.
Okay, and give us another plug for your podcast, because if people listening to this like Mormon history, you have a Mormon history podcast that actually got, how many episodes do you have now?
I'm putting out 168 this week.
You're almost caught up to me with Year of Polygamy.
Almost. I'm really trucking along. So I wanted to understand Mormon history within a chronological timeline, because that's how I best understand history, is from start to finish. Drop a pin, start here, drop a pin, it ends here. So that's what I decided to do, is make Joseph Smith's history in a serialized format. And so episode 1 of Naked Mormonism starts with the birth of Joseph Smith. And now episode 168, I am just beginning the series on the Council of 50. So the entire timeline of Joseph Smith is included in those 168 episodes. And we're getting really close to Carthage, so it's a lot of fun right now.
Well, we plan on having you back more, so thank you for being part of this.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me. It's really a pleasure.
Well, I've seen the devil's shadow underneath the moon. Keep that fire going. The sun is coming soon.
And the reason why I bring that up is, it very rarely do I see these small religious groups who are having these kind of experiences in the present day that don't involve some sort of substance use in their spiritual practice. So whether that be wine, whether that be essential oils, whether that be this kind of thing, I think that it's an interesting theory. But another interesting part of the spiritual life of this group dealt with the idea of revelation. So they had heard from the missionaries how Joseph Smith was receiving the word of God and committing it to paper. And this clearly impacted them. They reported experiences of having writing come down from the sky, sometimes in gold letters, that they would copy down. I really wish at this point that I could tell you that some of this survived, but alas, no dice. Perhaps the best known of these accounts involves Black Pete. As George A. Smith later told it, Pete chased one of these revelations, intriguingly carried by, quote, a black angel, off the steep bank of a river where he totally ate it and came out with plenty of scratches. Okay, I lied. Earlier when I said none of the revelations from the sky survived, sort of. Eber D. Howe printed a text in Mormonism Unveiled that was a call to missionary service, a call to preach repentance. By the time it was published, it had changed a bit and erased the fact that it was a communication to Black Pete. What I find fascinating is how it mirrors elements of Joseph Smith's revelations. The commission mentions that the call would be found on a piece of parchment, like the text from John the Beloved, now in D&C 7. Also, the language in Black Pete's call, very much like Joseph Smith's revelations calling the people on mission. So it's almost like Joseph Smith fanfic.
Probably with gore and vampires and zombies or something, too. All right, a few more thoughts on what their meetings involved. We'll call this one Snowball Express. One observer described a meeting in which a few people, quote, rolled a large snowball on the roof and placed it on the top of the chimney. The house soon filled with smoke and drove the people out, except those who had the power. Soon the snow melted and fell down the chimney and scattered the fire and ashes about the room. Those who had the power immediately got over it and left the room. While the room was being cleaned, Black Pete, who was a good singer, harangued the people out of doors, close quote. Tell me that's not an interesting meeting. Another report of a meeting claimed that people would stand on their seats and reach up for a tree and pick, quote, ambrosial fruit, close quote, and then pretend to eat it. For those listening who no longer attend the church, admit it. If there had been more pretend eating of ambrosial fruit, wouldn't that kind of have changed the equation?
I think so.
Plain and true, saw something that few people do. Lord God, I think I've seen enough.
Okay, let's revisit what is becoming my favorite hobby horse, playing Indian, that we've mentioned more than just a couple of times. So remember that there's this widespread interest in sort of articulating the origin of the Native American tribes. The mound builders particularly sparked the imagination of people, and apparently Joseph Smith was included in this. We know that he had a fascination with this. Zelph, the white Lamanite, anyone? We shared the observations of John Whitmer, who described people slithering on the floor, which they called sailing in the boat to the Lamanites, which is a rad band name if you want it really long and sort of indie. What is fascinating is Mark Staker points out that this practice, minus the Lamanites, obviously, was a common practice in traditional African-American ecstatic religious experience, but was also unknown in white religious communities. So guess who was part of the community at this point? Daniel Stanton and one of his daughters. One of them, Lucy, later married William McCary, and they, you know, made careers out of playing Indian. William McCary was, we think, a black or native actor that sort of came in and played Indian for the Mormons. Stay tuned because that's an absolutely fascinating story, which we'll tell more about later.
Back at HQ in New York, Joseph Smith hears about the mass conversions, but not yet the diverse religious expression that's going down. Not to keep playing the hits too much here, but remember that news traveling from Missouri back to headquarters comes by a guy on a horse, or from the mail, which comes by a guy on a horse. So it's January by the time John Whitmer, who has been assigned to go and watch over things in Kirtland, arrives on the scene. And this is where we get that most oft-quoted description of sailing in the boat to the Lamanites and all that. Mark Staker makes a good point here, though. He says that this probably reflects more of Whitmer's later perspective rather than his contemporary thoughts on what was happening in Kirtland. And at any rate, this leads us back to our good friend Mr. Conundrum. Spiritual gifts are all well and good, but what happens when others, not named Joseph Smith, start getting revelations? You might be sick of this theme already, but we just want to make sure you realize this is a really big issue in early Mormonism.
And if you know anything about religious communal sects that happened, some, you know, anything from cults to communal sects, then what you understand is oftentimes they're a reflection of what's going on in the larger world. So if environmental concerns are part of that, then you'll find people together of one heart, of one mind, trying to live in a more environmentally sustainable way, for example. Or if you're a doomsday sort of thinker, then you're responding to the end and the destruction and things like that. But everyone's sort of responding to that. And this is no different. Early Mormonism was just responding to the events around them, right? How to farm, how to settle, how to colonize areas in community. So back to John Whitmer, it doesn't seem like his authority was taken too seriously. And let's face it, it doesn't seem like he was much of a take charge guy to begin with. So the result, when you don't have a good charismatic leader in one of these, is all the newly minted Mormons, much like Tony and Angela, weren't quite sure who's the boss. Listen to what Levi Hancock said, quote, "Edson Fuller would bear testimony of the truth of the work, and I believed it like a fool. I dared not come out against anything that an elder would say for fear I should speak against the Holy Ghost. I let them go on this way until the people got mad and tried to convince me that I was led astray," end quote. So gaslighting 1830 style, ladies and gentlemen, that's when you know you're getting into a little shady area, is when people start to be afraid to speak up or to express themselves. And a fun tangent, Fuller's sister Laura married a Hubble and is a candidate for our Ms. Hubbles from the Bad Girls episode. In addition, not only would this likely come as a big surprise, but the family at this time now starts to have some troubles. Communal living is not easy, and I actually don't know of people that do it for very long. The Mormons gave it the good old college try, though. It's not all hippies and flowers and going to Grateful Dead freakouts. Let's be honest, maybe that's why it didn't work. There was no Grateful Dead. If a principle of your community is everything belongs to everyone, without some sort of structure, problems arise. And one notable example, Levi Hancock talking to Isaac Morley when He-Man Bassett comes walking up. Yep, He-Man.
By the power of Grayskull!
Which one of you is related to He-Man? Tough to top that name. Hancock described how Bassett, quote, took my watch out of my pocket and walked off as though it was his. I thought he would bring it back soon, but was disappointed as he sold it. I asked him what he meant by selling my watch. Oh, said he, I thought it was all in the family. I told him I did not like such a family doing, and I would not bear it, end quote. I like this. I like that all things in common means you can just rip something off of somebody's person and go pawn it off. That sounds good to me.
I will never be able to forget He-Man Bassett because I had a missionary companion who was actually a descendant of He-Man Bassett. So if Nick Bassett is listening to this somewhere, I got your back, buddy. So as all this is taking place in Kirtland, Joseph Smith is announcing the revelation to, quote, gather at the Ohio. So by late January, he and others prepare to leave New York, which we talked a little bit about. And as we talked about, there were some other motivations, obviously, like debts. And you can just imagine the scene when Joseph, brother Joseph, the prophet Joseph, finally gets to Kirtland. Joseph, He-Man took my watch. Is that doctrinal? Joseph, do you want to come sailing in the boat with us? Joseph, I got a revelation that floated down from the sky in gold letters, and it said, I'm in charge now. Is that cool? Joseph, hi, my name's Lehman Copley, and I've got a big old farm nearby. Can we just put a whole bunch of people there, and this will be totally permanent, and we're in no way going to, you know, rethink this very soon? So Joseph is everyone wants to talk to Joseph when he gets there. And any parent who's come home from work or the store to face 78 simultaneous questions knows the right way to handle this is to say, hey, you know, I just actually need to pee first, and then we'll talk about this. And He-Man, you give Levi back his watch. Apparently, the day he arrived, Joseph Smith dictated a revelation that really didn't address much of anything, but it did hint again that the law would be given. 5 days later, a very important revelation, including the law, would begin to finally create some stability and structure there, but that's a story for another day.
I just gotta say, I love these early Mormon hippies, and anytime someone in your Sunday school class wants to get all uptight about what Mormonism should be, you remind them where we came from.
Books of Mormon report for the day. Hearken, O Ye People, the historical setting of Joseph Smith's Ohio revelations, written by Mark Staker, published by Greg Coford Books. This is a fantastic book. If you think you know all about the Ohio period and what's going down in Kirtland, trust me, you don't. This will be a great read for you. His treatment of this early Ohio period is just fantastic. We leaned on it very heavily for this episode. Eminent Mormon historian Richard Bushman said of the book, quote, I am not aware of a more deeply researched and richly contextualized study of any period of Mormon church history than Mark Staker's study of Mormons in Ohio, close quote. That's a good recommendation there. It has excellent analysis of the role of Black Pete, which is actually how the book starts, and someone, like we said, we'll talk about more. And also, it includes probably the best study of the rise and fall of the Kirtland Safety Society, another important topic for the future.
As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.